Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, author Benjamin Taylor talks about his latest book, one that explores the life of a celebrated American novelist. His Chasing Bright Medusas, The Life of Willa Cather, was published in November 2023 by Viking Press. Benjamin Taylor was interviewed by fellow biographer and BIO member Gretchen Holberg-Gerzina.
And today, I'm really happy to be talking to Benjamin Taylor. Benjamin Taylor is an award-winning biographer and memoirist. In 2021, he received a literature award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He's published two memoirs, one of them about his friendship with Philip Roth. His biography of Marcel Proust, The Search, was named a New York Times Editor's Choice in 2015. His new book, A Biography of Willa Cather, has been described as an elegant exploration of artistic endurance. I think that's quite true and very apt. So Benjamin Taylor, I'm so glad to be talking with you today.
Good to be with you, Gretchen.
We tend to think of biographies as long explorations of a person's life, yet yours, well, it does take on the full life of Willa Cather, is much shorter. I wondered why you chose this less, I guess, expansive form.
Well, when I began writing the book, I had no idea what length it would be. I just wrote and wrote till I got to the end of what I had to say.
I was expecting when I said, yes, I would love to do this interview, that I was going to get a doorstopper of a book. And it was actually a rather slender volume. And it made me wonder what has to change. Presumably, if you had not realized it was going to be short, didn't have a length in mind, did you have to make decisions about what you wanted to include or not?
Well, you know, the previous biography I'd written, which was a biography of Proust, had to be short, maximum of 65,000 words. That was for the Yale Jewish Lives, and they stipulate the size of the book that they want you to write. So the habit of condensing, the habit of brevity was with me. And I found earlier biographies of Cather to be informed, cogent, but also rather shapeless. Not particularly readable. And I wanted, above all, to write a readable little book that tells the whole story.
What do you mean by shapeless?
Full of poorly digested information.
So not necessarily about the structure of the book, but just lots of information, not all of it accurate.
No, I think that Woodress, for example, Woodress's biography has a lot of information, all of it very accurate. He's a very reliable scholar, but I wanted to write something briefer and more artistic.
I like that you bring in the word artistic. I was wondering if anything changes in the biographical research process if you're using a shorter form or longer form. Is it always the same? I mean, what about the structure, the dramatic arc, research, any of that?
Yes, I did feel there was a dramatic arc, but it puts her at variance with her younger contemporaries, Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald. These were blighted lives, truly blighted lives, blighted by alcoholism, by mental disease, by all kinds of trouble. Whereas in the case of Willa Cather, you just don't get any of those stories. The pitfalls were for others. She made a life for herself on her own terms. She was extremely organized and extremely uncrazy. So the arc of the book is one of long self-fulfillment, and the latter half of her career is even stronger than the first half. So I think that I went into this with the realization that here was somebody who had gotten everything she wanted from life. She did exactly what she meant to do, and then died in her mid-70s.
I had so many questions because it's such a cogent and compelling read. I read it very quickly. That doesn't always happen with a biography where I'm trying to keep all the names and facts straight. And I kind of zipped right along with this. And I have to say that your admiration for Cather really shines through in this book. I've gotten the sense with some other biographies that the biographer is tired of their subjects, but you give a sense of warmth and admiration. And I wondered how you chose Cather. Did you choose her as your subject? What drew you to her life and work?
Well, that goes all the way back to sixth grade and Mrs. Westbrook's sixth grade class. She would take us once a week to the school library, and we could pick a book, or she would pick a book for us, or recommend a book. And she recommended to me My Antonia, and said, as pronouncing it correctly, Antonia, and said, this is a book about a girl. I usually only recommend it to the girls, but it's told by a boy, so I'm giving it to you. So for my assignment, I read My Antonia. Who knows what I got out of it at that age, age 11 or 12. That was the start for me. And she's been with me ever since. Back in the 50s, her reputation was at a low ebb. It was second wave feminism that brought her to the fore. And her reputation has just grown and grown ever since. So I feel I'm one of a multitude now who unconditionally admire this marvelous writer.
It's interesting that you talk about how her reputation was at a low ebb and then it began to rise with certain other perspectives about her work and her life. And I have to admit that I had a really different view of Willa Cather before reading your book. There are a lot of reductive exaggerations of her character, at least that's what I thought I knew, but your book sets straight. For instance, you know, I thought, oh, she was a wild feminist and she was determined and angry. I mean, these are the things that people were saying about her work.
The great moral cause of her time, suffrage, moved her not at all. She didn't care a whit about votes for women, and I doubt that she did vote once she could.
What else would surprise people who had this other view of her? I have this vision of her going off to university named William Cather.
Yes, and dressing like a boy, briefly. Yeah. Beginning her career, her long career in journalism there at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. What else surprised me? That she suffered so little for love. She found first one great love, Isabel McClung, and then after Isabel married, she found another great love, who was Edith Lewis. Her home life was as stable and ordinary as one can imagine, with Edith particularly. Isabel was the great love of her life. Edith was the other love of her life, the one with whom she domesticated all her instincts. And Edith survived her by many years. Edith died only in the 1970s. What surprised me was that there are, beyond a college crush she had, there are no agonies for love, except for Isabel, then never again. She was really determined to have things her way. Was she lesbian? Well, yes, but she would never have used that word to describe herself. So many of those women who lived in so-called Boston marriages would not have used that word to describe themselves. They knew they were spinsters who lived together in order not to live alone, but that these were connubial attachments, marital attachments, mostly didn't occur to people as it immediately does occur to us. It was a different era in so many respects, and a different era in that respect, too. People assumed homosexuality was rare and a disease. It's neither.
You said something a moment ago that really struck me, because she comes across as, in your book, as determined. Like she was a real workhorse, yet she was somebody who chose her own path, even when it meant writing a book that others didn't believe in, but that she did. But I was really intrigued by the way she built this career. You know, she starts as a university student working at the university and writing there. And then I always thought of her as a Midwesterner. So there's so many things to unpack in here, because she was a Midwesterner, but not for most of her life. But the work aspect of her life is really intriguing to me. She was writing all the time, and in ways that we didn't always expect her to be writing, because she wasn't just a novelist.
Yes, she was also a gifted essayist and a wonderful letter writer.
And how did she build this career of hers?
Oh, through grit and luck. Luck is always the imponderable element in any of these triumphant stories. In addition to all these other blessings, she had good health. This might all seem unpromising for a biographer, but I reveled in her good fortune. I found myself wishing it were mine.
She began, as we just said, as a Midwestern writer. So I was so surprised to find out how well-traveled she was and how many different places she actually lived in, or even though New York was her home for so many years, in fact, most of her adult life, but that she spent a lot of time in Europe and that she had done lots of other things that I didn't imagine. I thought of her in some farm or in Nebraska for all of her life, struggling for her art.
No, she got a job in Pittsburgh at a ladies' magazine, so-called ladies' magazine of the day. And then she got the call to come to New York. She pioneered her way eastward, you could say, from Red Cloud to Lincoln, from Lincoln to Pittsburgh, from Pittsburgh to New York. And here in New York, she had a very important job. She was managing editor of a muckraking magazine of the day called McClure's. And she bought a lot of very good fiction for that magazine. It was only when she left McClure's to write full time that she began producing the books we know her by. O Pioneers, The Song of the Lark, My Antonia. These were the Prairie trilogy that she wrote, very consciously mining out the material of her childhood and youth, all the Nebraska material, the Red Cloud material, and in short stories too. She was a marvelous short story writer. There was one about the body of a great sculptor being returned to his shabby hometown in the Midwest. She could deliver harsh verdicts on where she came from. But my sense is that she would never have wanted it any other way. She would never have wanted to be from anywhere else. She loved intellectually conquering France. She was a great Francophile before she ever got to France. France, she thought of as her second country.
And what was her relationship with her family?
Well, that's interesting. She remained quite close and went out to Nebraska every year for a visit. They had moved early on from the farm into the city. Mr. Cather, William Cather, had a real estate business. So that was where she did most of her growing up. And that third floor bedroom, her sanctum, appears in book after book. That house in Red Cloud is ground zero of Cather's studies for a reason, because she used her past so extravagantly well.
So we've got this woman who's growing up in the Midwest, determined that she is going to be a writer, perhaps not sure in what way, makes her way, as you said, pioneering her way eastward, living in New York, feeling that France is her second home. She didn't feel so happy about England as well, as I understand it.
No, she found England insular and provincial. It was France and Italy, but above all France, that captured her imagination. She had a very good grasp of written French. She always spoke French, but haltingly. She read French fluently.
I was thinking about France because I was thinking about the war and the First World War, and she wrote this novel that took her a long time, and she was determined to write it. Could you tell us about that book? Because it's not one we talk about.
You mean one of ours?
I love it.
I think it's one of the great documents from the World War I era. She felt that she had a sneaking suspicion that war was glorious after all. Her protagonist and his great friend died together and gloriously in battle, something like the death in battle of Robert de Saint-Loup in Proust's In Search of Lost Time. It begins on a farm and ends in the killing fields of France, the trenches, the trench warfare of France. And it's a big book. It's the last big book she wrote. After she wrote that, she went through a kind of crisis. It's interesting that what provoked the nearest thing to a depressive spell in her life was success, a Pulitzer Prize. She said in 1922, the war, or thereabouts, the world broke in two. I don't know about the world, but her career breaks in two in 1922. What you have on the one side are these big books, One of Ours, The Song of the Lark, and so on. She never attempts a big book again after that. And she wrote an essay called the novel Des Meubles, the unfurnished novel, which she establishes a new ideal, fictional ideal, that is brief and pungent and shapely.
And one of ours, is it not, maybe I'm misreading, is it not based on a member of her family or someone she knew or cared about?
A cousin.
And she wanted his story to be told.
And she wanted his story to be told. G.P. Cather, he was called.
Can you tell us about some of her other books? Because the one I am most familiar with is one I read, I think, when I was a graduate student. And it really stuck with me. And I don't know the other books as well, but The Professor's House really struck a chord with me back then. It probably isn't one that people turn to first, but it's the one I think of, and I still have my copy from back then. And it does take place in the Midwest, but I was hoping you could tell us a bit more about what happens in that book, because I found it very poignant.
Oh, it's my favorite of all her books. I love that. That's the book she writes immediately after One of Ours. I'm sorry, A Lost Lady is what she writes immediately. And then after that, Professor's House, which tells the story of a great friendship between a younger man and a mature man with no hint of Eros about it. That's not the story. It's an intellectual friendship. And the young man is Tom Outland, and the professor is Godfrey St. Peter. And though the book doesn't say this straight out, it doesn't dramatize this, only reports it. The professor, who is a historian on the order of Parkman or of Michelet or of Gibbon, who happens to be teaching at a second-rate Midwestern university and has published a history of the Spaniards in America. He's at work on the third volume. When Tom Outland, who has no high school diploma even, comes into his life and asks to be taken under his wing, which he does. Tom Outland is a boy who grew up in the Southwest, in Pardee, New Mexico, and knows that landscape like the back of his hand. And he, in the end, is the great assistant to the professor and brings warmth, vividness, and cogency to what had begun as a rather dry intellectual exercise. The professor becomes a great historian through the agency of Tom Outland.
I just love this book, and especially because of its use of landscape and the Native American artifacts and all of that area that Tom brings to the professor.
Yes. Tom knows everything about the Anasazi ruins, as he tells the professor. Over the course of one long evening, Tom narrates his whole life story to the professor. And the professor is in love. Not bodily in love, but in love. This was the intended husband of his eldest daughter. And Tom has left behind a patent that turns out to be very valuable. Among other things, the story is about money, how it changes people.
I was also surprised by the issue of religion. What role did religion play in her life?
Oh, well, that's interesting. She enjoyed religion. She enjoyed going to mass. She would occasionally, for convenience sake, go to the Catholic Church, Dominican Church of St. Vincent Ferrer, here in Upper Manhattan, where I am. And she would also go to Church of the Ascension down at 5th and 10th Street, I guess it is. She enjoyed the liturgy. She enjoyed the pomp and elegance of the Catholic liturgy. It did not bore her. This is what I sometimes say to people who have the habit of going to church. What are you going to hear that you haven't already heard there? And did she believe in God? Well, yes, I guess so. She believed in God. She also thought that these lives that were religiously dedicated had great harsh beauty to them. For instance, in Death Comes for the Archbishop. After she wrote that book, everybody assumed she was Catholic. She wasn't Catholic. She was Episcopalian and had started out Baptist.
Books often end with the slow decline. The biographies do. Some biographies begin with the death and then move backwards or start over again. But this one seemed like, and I don't want to give it away because I want everyone to read this book because it's really great. She has a kind of quiet warmth and fondness for young people and not burdening others. And I was really struck by the relationship she had at the end of her life.
A great friendship with a little boy, Yehudi Menuhin, who would come with his sisters for visits to Aunt Willa, as they called her. That was a very considerable blessing in her life, having young Yehudi. In the essays, she says, after 50, it simply rains death. The trouble, as I've discovered with having great friends a generation older, is that you have to say goodbye to every single one of them. She wanted younger friends and went out and found them.
It's another instance of her blazing her own path, finding her own way through a life and through her work, isn't it?
Yes, she was an original. I'm so grateful to have written this life rather than Hemingway's or Fitzgerald's or Faulkner's.
So am I, so that you've done this life. What would you like readers of this biography of Willa Cather to take away from your book?
Will is not a mystery, but creativity is. Creativity really is, in the end, mysterious. And you're dealing in a book like this with the protagonist who spent 3 hours every day writing and doing nothing else. But she also had more of the attributes of what we would call a normal life, going out to the Jefferson Market to pick veal chops. She was going to have her cook do that evening, answering mail. In her last years, was stricken with a severe tendinitis in her right hand and found she couldn't write anymore. So 1940, Sapphira and the Slave Girl is her last book. I would say, yes, read that. That's truly forgotten, Sapphira and the Slave Girl. That tells the story of not Willa's Nebraska origins, but goes even further back to her Shenandoah Valley origins. And in the Shenandoah Valley, she spent her first 8 years and did not return to that material until late in life. So that's a book published in 1940. After that, the difficulty of writing leads her to try to dictate fiction, but she finds she can't. She reaches the end of her writing career 7 years before she dies. And that's the great sorrow in her life.
Well, it was a great pleasure for me to have this conversation with you. I've been talking to Benjamin Taylor about his book, Chasing Bright Medusas, A Life of Willa Cather, a book I highly recommend and really enjoyed our conversation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Gretchen. So long.
That was author Benjamin Taylor speaking with Gretchen Holberg-Gerziner about his latest book, Bright Medusas, The Life of Willa Cather. It was published by Viking Press in November 2023, and we recorded this interview via Zoom last year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.